From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with Listen, the podcast that highlights the common threads that run through different cultures and unite us as human beings. Today marks the beginning of Season 6, a series of interviews about writing and writers. What do successful authors have in common? How have they chosen their preferred medium? What inspiration can you draw from them if you've dreamed of writing something of your own? Whether you are passionate about novels, plays, screenplays, or poetry, we hope you'll join us for these insightful conversations. My guest today is Devorah Rogers. A writer and consumer researcher, she is co-author of Fire in the Zoo and author of The Spanish Painter. Devorah is a regular public speaker, and her TEDx talk on the future of shopping and retail has been viewed over 235,000 times. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband, daughter, and ornery cat. When we recorded this interview, she was on lockdown in her home, so you may be able to hear her loved ones in the background from time to time. Welcome, Devorah. I'm so glad you could be with us today.
Hey, Kate. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to do this with you.
Me too. I'd love to start with some of the practicalities before we delve into the specifics of your experience. Can you share how long it took you to write your novel, The Spanish Painter, and how you went about it?
It took me 13 years to write the book. But wow. I want to say that most of that was not writing.
Okay.
Most of that was beating myself up and saying, why am I not writing? Mm-hmm. Telling myself that I needed to get my butt in the seat, taking writing classes where I would make a little bit of progress and then go a year or two and make no progress and then make some progress. And finally, after my daughter was born, I was like, this must be done. And I did all I could at every moment I could to bring it together. Mm-hmm. There were some key moments. I did National Novel Writing Month mm-hmm. at one point. That helped me finally have a finished book. Mm-hmm. Then there was another point where I went to my parents' house in Joshua Tree, California, and edited it. Mm-hmm. Then several years went by and I did nothing and I had a kid. I guess I didn't do nothing, but I had a kid.
Yeah, no big whoop. No big deal.
And then after I had the kid, I was like, I cannot keep going without this done. This has to come full mm-hmm. circle. And that was when I finally finished it.
When you started writing it, did you know that you were starting to write a novel? Or was it sort of, you know, scraps of paper and notes? Or did you know what it was when you started writing?
I did. I knew that it was a bigger story than I had ever written. I'd always written like poems or prose, little short, not so much short stories, but short essays. And with this, I felt that there was a full story to be told, but I had no idea how to do it. In fact, I still don't. I think my biggest challenge as a writer is that I'm a little bit lazy about organization. Okay, I'm a lot lazy about organization. And I don't understand how to create effective outlines. I can do it for work, although I usually also don't create outlines. So my disorganization as a writer has been a big challenge because it keeps me from being able to then move forward. It's not hard for me to write on little scraps of paper and kind of get the characters going and get the scenes going. But when I have to tie it all together to make something, I just really fight it.
I find that so interesting because your book in particular, and we'll get into the specifics later, but it's not a linear story. I mean, there are three different narratives going on and they're all sort of beautifully braided together, plated together. And it works. I mean, you could have fooled me that you didn't know what you were doing and still don't know what you're doing because it just all came together. Would you attribute any of that to an editor? Did you work with an editor?
I did work with an editor. I worked with two. I worked with initial editor Michael Gaylord, who had worked with me on business projects, mm-hmm. you know, ebooks, stuff like that. And he lives in Spain, and he was a really good choice for me. And then I worked with you, and even
we
though I
did,
knew you,
although I wouldn't call myself one of the editors of this book.
No, but you really played an important role, and there were on a couple of occasions there were moments where I just couldn't. So the way that I work is I work in bursts, and I can have a lot, I can accomplish a lot and get a lot done, and then I run out of steam. And when I run out of steam, I have to have somebody who kind of helps me come in and fills in some of the gaps. Mm-hmm. And there were several moments when I was going through the book where I reached out to you and where you helped me fill in cultural details or you helped me do some research. I'm also, it was funny, I'm for somebody whose business is research, I'm actually a shitty researcher when it comes to writing books.
You're revealing quite a few secrets in this conversation.
I know, it's true. I love Ann Patchett, and she really does a lot of research, and she really spends a lot of time on the bones of her books, and it mm-hmm. shows. Mm-hmm. And so if I have one goal over the next few years, when we finally get over this coronavirus and life maybe comes back at some level, I would really like to go to a writing workshop. My problem with writing workshops is that I'm always a little bit too experienced of a writer for some groups and not experienced enough for others. So it's hard for me to find the right group.
And are there any kind of filters? I'm not really familiar with that world, with the world of, you know, workshops and retreats and that sort of thing. Is there any way to find a group who's sort of more on your wavelength or on your level of experience?
I think there's a lot of offerings out there. There's a lot of stuff for women. There's a lot of different types of groups. And I met a woman through a networking group here last year, and she was writing a novel that she had not yet completed. And she was already really active in a particular group. So I think that there are a lot of great groups out there, and I'm really hopeful that I can participate in them once I get a better sense of what projects I want to do in the future. I have two in mind, but I'm not exactly sure which one I'm going to tackle.
And is that another novel or something different?
Yeah, I have one story that is something that happened to me over the last couple of years that's quite personal, and I'm trying to figure out if there's a way in which I can tell that story in a way that, you know, is also protective of the people involved. Mm-hmm. The other is a story about my grandfather's sister, Elise, who I'm named after, and her daughter, Liana. Elise and Liana were murdered in the Holocaust. And I had known about Elise, but we became German citizens, my daughter and my mom and I, this year. We reclaimed our German citizenship. And when we went to the consulate, the specialist who works with Holocaust victims and their families let us know about Liana, who was 4 years old, which at the time was the age of my daughter. And I was very moved by this little girl who I hadn't even known existed. And I wanted to try to create a story about not so much the Holocaust, but their relationship living inside. Funny enough, I wanted to write a story about what it means to be locked in your home for months. They had means, they had resources, they were wealthy. And so I don't know what their lives were like, but I know that up until the very end, they were somewhat comfortable until things got really bad. And it's kind of funny now that I'm saying it, it sounds a lot like the moment that we're in now in regard to being in one's home and having to stay inside and having to figure out how to manage the spirits and energy of a little being that doesn't understand why they have to stay inside.
Right. So, and manage that and somehow explain it when you yourself have no idea how serious it is, how long it's going to go on. I mean, as mothers, we're charged with explaining the world to our children, you know, helping them make sense of overwhelming circumstances. And the, you know, current circumstances are completely overwhelming. I mean, really, this is the first time in in my son's life, you know, and my life as a mother, that we're going through something together that my husband and I have never known the likes of. And I think that's everyone else's case as well. I mean, we're all three of us, Rodrigo and Lucas and I, are all going through this together for the first time.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other day, so for my daughter, she is referring now, everything that Eden refers to is before the coronavirus or when the coronavirus is over. Wow. So she's already living in a before and an after, and it's only been, you know, 6 weeks or whatever it's been. So that's one thing. Although the other day, to your point, she was saying, we were talking about the coronavirus and I was expressing just what you expressed, that this is unprecedented, that I've never experienced anything like this, that this is unusual for kind of everybody. And she goes, well, there was the 1918 Spanish flu.
How did she know that?
I don't know. This kid, she doesn't forget anything, and she, you know,
somebody
hears
mentioned
everything.
It in her yep. presence. Oh my yep. goodness.
But that was good perspective, because, you know, for those people, they'd never experienced anything like that, and then they had to go through it for years, and then we all forgot about it, and now here we are.
Right, exactly. And that's history. That's the definition of history, right?
Mm-hmm.
Coming back to your book, can you tell us what we've talked a little bit about the writing process, the creative process. What about publishing? What was that process like? Because your book is published, it is available, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But how did you get to that point?
Well, you know, I did not even try to go through traditional publishing channels. I was out of steam. I was also, my husband was finishing a book at the same time, and we were focused on, I felt like his book really merited a publisher. That's probably a female thing, right? Like somehow his book merited a publisher.
All but the energy for him.
I made the choice that mine didn't. And so we went down the path looking for an agent for him. But I just was like, I just need this to exist and live and be done. And so I published it through Amazon. At the time, they had a company called CreateSpace, which they've since bought. And it's really easy now to design and publish your books. I mean, even in a couple of years, it's easier. So that's what I did. And I put it on Amazon, but I never marketed it, unfortunately. And, you know, hopefully at some point I'll write another book and then, you know, over time.
Yeah, piggyback maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I hope you do write another book.
Thank you.
Can you talk us through the book's plot a little bit? I mean, no spoilers, but what are the broad strokes of the story?
So the broad strokes of the story are that there is a young woman who discovers the mysterious origins of her conception and her birth to her mother, and it turns out a Spanish painter who she did not know growing up, she didn't know about, and she did not know. And the book is centered around her journey to go discover who this man is, who her father is, and who she is. And in doing so, she actually develops a relationship with someone who becomes as, or I would say more important than the relationship with her father that she thought she was going to Spain to seek.
Listen, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to hear all about the story behind the story and the incredible woman who inspired Devora to write her first novel. Back in a second.
Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit www.rafsanpedro.es. That's www.rafsanpedro.es.
This is Kate Jetmore with Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Devora Rogers, who's talking about her novel, The Spanish Painter. I really want to talk about the woman who inspired this entire creative endeavor, Flores. Who is she and how did you meet?
So Flores is an extraordinary human being who I was lucky enough to get to know by kind of unusual circumstances. I had met a man during my junior year abroad in Toulouse. He was German, so he was European, lived in Europe.
And you were studying in France, right?
I was studying in France, and I joined a German theater group. I spoke no German at the time. but I was really
studying abroad in France. What makes sense right now?
I was bored, and a friend of mine, her roommates were learning German, and so they invited us in, and it was a lovely little group, and I met this man who was so handsome and, you know, 9-10 years older than me, and I just fell head over heels for him. And we ended up falling into a relationship together. I came back, finished my degree, and then we were trying to figure out a way to go and be together, and he knew of this place in Cuenca, Spain, where he had taken Spanish lessons. And he said, you know, I bet I can get us jobs. My English is good enough, he was saying, and it was, to teach mm-hmm. English, and your English is certainly solid. And he said, let's do that. And so he got us jobs, and, you know, I worked under the table, and I basically, after I finished my degree, I was going to go back and meet him in Spain, and we were, I thought, going to live together. Mm-hmm. And I get to Spain, and he has a cute little apartment, and I'm thinking we're going to play house together. And he's like, you know, I think you should get your own place. And I was like, get my own place? I just moved to Spain to be with you.
To be with you, yeah.
But he was German. I don't know. He wanted his own space. And it ended up being the most fortuitous thing ever in the world. And every time in life when things happen that I don't want to have happen or that I'm fighting, I try to remember this moment. Because if he had not demanded that I get my own apartment, I would never have met Flores.
And why is that?
Well, I had to find an apartment. And so the director of the school where we were working said he would help me. And he comes back one day and he says, you know, I met this old lady and she's kind of strange, but, you know, it's a whole thing. Go see her. She's going to clean your room for you, by the way. That comes with the rent. There's nothing you can do. That's part of the deal. And she lived in what's known as the Casas Colgadas, the hanging houses, which I was quite taken with this idea that I was going to be living in a hanging house over the cliffs. And I tried to imagine.
These are really famous houses here in Spain. They're ancient. I mean, I think some of them are really, really old. Others are, you know, it's funny to hear Spaniards say, oh, that's only 200 years old. You know, for an American, it's like only 200 years. But anyway, what you do is you walk into the building on one of the top floors. And then as you walk down the steps, all of those lower floors are kind of cleaved to the edge of the cliff. And if you look up at the building from down in the gorge at the level of the river, it looks kind of like a skyscraper. Like they look like they're 8 stories tall, but they're not. Like only, you know, all of it is sort of against the rock and anchored on the rock.
Right. And they were built that way to protect the town, right? Because if mm-hmm. you built the homes into the hillside hanging over the cliffs, then, you know, when the invaders came, I guess it would have been the Moors, you mm-hmm. could protect yourselves, right? And so she lived in one of these. And so before I met her, I imagined what this place looked like. And it was every bit as beautiful as I had imagined. And, you know, essentially what ended up happening was Flores was renting a little flat that now she lives in. She used to live in a bigger home in the same building. And she was renting out that little flat, which had been just like a little studio or a little, almacén. What's that in English?
Like a little pantry or like a warehouse, like a storage room.
Like a storage room. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she had turned it into, she had added, you know, a bathroom and a kitchen, and she was renting it as her source of income. Mm-hmm. And so she, you know, it was vacant and she was looking for a renter. And so I ended up renting from her, and it was half my income. It was a lot of money for me. And, you know, but that was the deal. And there was no, once I saw it, there was no scenario I was going to live anywhere else.
Right.
Or with anyone else. I mean, she, she became my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I'd never had a grandmother in my life before. My grandmothers were both dead by the time I was born. Mm-hmm. And she and I became very close. So what happened is I moved in, and then little by little we got to know each other. She would leave me little bits of bread or cake. She would clean the room. I would often feel badly about her cleaning the room, which of course I was paying for, but as an American, I'd never had like somebody cleaning my house every day. My mom never cleaned my room every day. Like I couldn't fathom it. And so she had these little things made for the door that symbolized whether she could go in or not, green or red cards that I would hang from the door. And so I would often leave it on red even when I would go out so that she didn't feel like she had to clean. And Aww. Then she would say, I know your little tricks. And then of course the whole room would be cleaned. And when I say the whole room was cleaned, like, I think we need to just spend a moment to understand what it looks like when a Spanish woman born in the first part of the 20th century cleans a room.
Please.
Because it does not, this doesn't exist.
First of all, let's talk about how Flores dressed. Because that was also, like, describe for us what she looked like. And then tell us a little bit about how she cared for the apartment, how she cared for you.
Right. Good point. So Flores has, what's the term for her hair color? I mean, what is that? It's like gray is not the right color. Silver. I couldn't think of the word silver. That's the COVID life for you. Can't think of the word silver. So Flores has amazingly silver hair that she keeps up always in a bun. I did not see her hair down till I knew her for years. Hmm. Always hair up, silver hair up in a tight, beautiful bun, perfectly coiffed, with a white apron, a full body white apron. She had a couple that were wraparounds, but she had the ones that she preferred were the button down, mm-hmm. always over her dress or whatever she was wearing underneath. You rarely ever saw whatever she was wearing underneath because she always wears the white apron.
It's even more than an apron. It's almost like a house coat. Well, like, gosh, I don't even know what to call it. But you're right. It covers her. It protects all of the clothes she's wearing underneath it. It's almost like a doctor's lab coat or something.
Almost like a doctor's lab coat, yeah, but fully closed. And then white.
And pristinely pressed and starched.
Oh, well, Flores does not happen without something being pristinely. I mean, everything that she touches is pristinely ironed and starched. And she has very complex methods for ironing and humidifying and all of the things that have to happen if you want something to come out of the laundry and look perfect when you wear it. So Flores had this perfectly coiffed silver bun, the white apron, very simple white moccasin shoes. And that was what she wore, always. And she would clean that room top to bottom. There were these gorgeous tiles, like Saltillo tiles, I think. And the bed she would make without a single crease, perfectly folded over. She would iron my linen shirt like it was the last piece of fabric on earth that needed to be cared for and make it last for 100 years. There were marble countertops in the kitchen that she had installed, and she would clean those top to bottom. She would put geraniums in the windows and water them. So she created a world that I had never lived in, quite literally. I had never, my mom's not much of a homemaker. She's not a homemaker. She doesn't cook well. She doesn't clean. She pays other people to clean. I had never lived in a home like the one Flores made for me. And we became friends. She would bring me things, and then we would chit chat in the hallway or in the doorway. And then soon she would start to come in, and I was having quite a hard time. I was very sad. I felt very lonely. I didn't like teaching English to children in particular. And I was really going through a hard time, and she would look at me and she'd say, you have sad eyes today. What's going on? And at one point I became ill and I had no energy to go out. I was really quite sick. And she came and massaged my feet in bed. She put me in bed. She said, get in bed. She made me hot liquids, tea with rosemary and honey. And she rubbed my feet. And she began telling me stories. And I became absolutely enamored with her. I only wanted to listen to her stories.
And were these stories about her own life?
Yeah, the stories were her own life, yeah. Yeah, they were, and she had, so I guess I haven't even said, well, who she is. I guess that's important.
Okay, well, who is she?
Okay, so Flores was the longtime partner of a well-known Spanish abstract painter named Bonifacio Alfonso. Mm-hmm. And she literally grew up as, you know, from her, you know, young adult years, in the world of art. She was not educated. Her education had been paused during the Spanish Civil War, and she never went back to school. Her father was in prison. They were in Basque Country, and he was imprisoned. And she never was able to go back and get her education. She ended up growing up in her parents' bar, and so she learned how to cook and clean, and that was the world that she lived in. And she married a well-to-do man who had a fishing supply business.
And he was also Basque, right? He was
Basque.
Up north.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. In San Sebastian. Mm-hmm. And one day, a man came in seeking to help them with sort of publicity and posters for their business. And that was Bonifacio. And he befriended Flores and her husband. And the three of them got to know each other and would eat together. And as it happened, she fell in love with him and he fell in love with her. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole story, which I get into in the book, about how that happened. And ultimately, you know, she left her husband for him.
And when would this have been? Like in the late 50s, 60s?
Let's see. So I think she's 88 right now. So if we do quick math, yeah, that would have been in the 50s, right?
Or maybe 60s, because wasn't she like in her 30s?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So yeah. Let's say it was 50, 55 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and so you know, Spain was still under Franco. She couldn't get divorced, nor could Bonifacio from his wife, who he had
because it was illegal.
It was illegal. Mm-hmm. And so, but she went to go live with him, and they ended up moving to Cuenca together, where Fernando Thobel, who was a patron of the arts, asked them to come and basically helped get them started in Cuenca and introduced him to the whole community of Antonio Sauda and all the other painters.
Right. So there's a very well-known and very well-regarded museum in Cuenca called the Spanish Abstract Art Museum, and it actually is located in one of the hanging houses. It's an amazing, amazing place. So they would have, Bonifacio sort of joined this community, that this creative visual art community of people who were reacting to the regime of Franco and to the dictatorship.
Absolutely.
Now, I just want to go back one second and clarify, yeah. Because you're telling us the story of a woman who exists and who you really knew and really know. But we're talking about your novel. So this is the woman and some other figures in her life who inspired this novel and who inspired some key characters in your novel, but they're fictionalized versions of real people.
That's right. That's right. So Flores began telling me her life story, basically. And she had a fascinating life story. She had, you know, left her husband at a time where that was not done, to go live with a painter with no means. She supported that painter, lived through craziness with, you know, a kind of a mad artist, if you will, was introduced to extraordinary people, had just an amazing life. And she starts telling me all these stories about her life. And as I'm listening to them, I'm like, this is the most exquisite storyteller I've ever come upon. And I must find a way to tell these stories. And that was when I began working on the book. I wanted to fictionalize it so that I just felt like I needed to find a way to make it be something that I could relate to and that I had business putting myself into. Like, I couldn't just create a story that only took place in Spain. I'm not Spanish. I didn't grow up in Spain. That didn't feel right. And so I looked for an inn that would allow me to tell her stories, a vehicle that would allow me to tell her stories. And that's ultimately what led to the book, The Spanish Painter, was my sort of search for how I could fairly tell a story that was not mine to tell, but that was being told to me and that I wanted to preserve at any cost. I felt like I needed to preserve her stories.
Mm. And it sounds like preserve her story, but also in doing so, preserve your relationship with her. It sounds like it was really, really important to you to come at it from a place that would feel right to you and that would also feel right to her.
That's true. As Flautist and I got to know each other better, there was a real ease in our relationship that I had never had with anyone. It was easy for us to be together, and my Spanish sucked, and she didn't speak any English. Initially, we spoke a little French, and then we switched over to Spanish when my Spanish got a little bit better, but, you know, my Spanish wasn't great, but we just became closer and closer, and we would sit in her then kitchen with the windows open and a breeze blowing in from the valley below in this gorgeous view over into the mountainside of Cuenca. And she would say, "Should we have champagne?" And after having just made me a 5-course meal, you know, we'd open a bottle of champagne and we'd sit there, you know, her 70 years old, me in my 20s. And somehow we always had enough to talk about. Mm-hmm. And it was so precious to me. I yes, you're right. It wasn't only her. It was also the experience of who I was with her and the great fortune I had to get to know her and to get to develop a friendship with her was one of the most extraordinary things I've ever experienced.
Mm. Devorah, we're going to take another short break, but we'll be right back to continue our conversation about your novel. We love your feedback. Let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. Subscribe to our podcast if you haven't already. Rate, review, and share, and be sure to recommend us to your friends and colleagues. You can find us on social media, and check out the new Listen blog on our website at thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Devorah Rogers about her wonderful novel, The Spanish Painter. Before we continue our conversation, let's let our listeners know how they can access your book. Why don't you tell people where they can find it? And we'll be sure to provide a link on our website as well.
The Spanish Painter is available at Amazon.com. And if you just do a quick search for The Spanish Painter and Devorah Rogers, it will come up and you can buy either a Kindle or a hard copy.
Great. Wonderful. Devorah, how did you decide that you wanted to turn Flautist's story into a novel?
I decided I wanted to turn Flautist's story into a novel when I was on one of my frequent walks through Cuenca. I didn't have much to do. This was kind of before social media and smartphones, and I had just a few channels of TV in the apartment that I rented from Flautist.
In Spanish.
Yeah, my boyfriend didn't want to be with me as often as not, so I had a lot of time on my hands, and so I would walk. And on those walks, I began to conceive of a story of a young woman who is conceived by a Spanish painter. And I began to imagine the story that would allow my entry into this story. And so that was where I felt like there was enough richness in the stories Flotus was telling me, enough richness in the story of the young woman who was going to look for her father and kind of her experience. And then I also wanted to tell the story of her mother and who her mother was, that she had this affair when she was a young woman. And so I ended up with three women characters, all who felt like they were a part of me and whose stories I wanted to tell. And Flotus was one of those. I was one of those. And then this other woman is not in any way reflective of my mother. I had to draw on other mothers that I know of. Although she's the mother in the story is the part of me that is the most difficult part of me. And so I guess in that regard, she's... I related to her a lot.
Can you talk a little bit about the things you learned from Flotus and how she taught you those things?
I learned a lot from Flotus. She was explicit in wanting to, you know, she wanted to teach me to cook. She wanted to express her point of view about the world. She didn't have children or grandchildren, so... You know, in a way, I sort of became that as other people had come through her life who she had played that role for, I believe. But Flotus taught me what it means to be human. Because Flotus is a real human. She, you know, grew up with an understanding of the, you know, really corrosive impact that an authoritarian government can have on lives and how unhuman, inhuman those characters are. So she was marked from the beginning by the contrast of Franco and the community that she had and the world that she really loved and respected in Basque Country, which she continues to have great respect for in terms of their form of government and justice and economics and all that kind of stuff. So she is kind of inherently a bit political. And so she taught me to kind of look at the world through who is in power and who is not. She also taught me a lot about caring for others, how you care for others. I mean, you know, if somebody comes to Flotus's apartment to fix something, she will make them a meal. There will be a there will be a hot meal on the table. And that level of care for others, the last 20 years of her life, she has not worked for a variety of reasons. She had to give up her kind of, she had to retire early to take care of her mother and different things. And she wasn't able to go back to work. So she worked by having this apartment and supporting and feeding people who lived in it and rented it from her. And when she could no longer do that, and now she lives in that apartment. She sold her home. She took care of all of the other elderly folks in the neighborhood for years. So she has a real sense of contribution to others that is quite profound. And I think that she, another thing that she really taught me is in the way that she had her home and cooked, she was very simple. She is very simple. Like in her kitchen, the staples would be rice, you know, lemon, rosemary,
salt.
Like there were just some very key elements that she always had present and she could fashion a meal out of. And you're like, how did you do this with rosemary, lemon, rice, and salt? And oh, and of course, parsley. You know, she usually had fresh parsley
and
on the
olive
counter.
Oil.
And olive oil. How could we forget? Yeah. So she taught me the simplicity of things. I mean, even in the way that she serves food, typically her preferred way of serving meals is, you know, in the United States, we put everything on the plate. You got your salad, you got your You got your meat, you got your side. It's all on the same plate. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have another dish for the salad. Yeah. But she served everything separately. So, and I don't know, maybe that's a common Spanish thing, but she took it to the next level where, you know, we would have some lettuce, very simple, mm-hmm. you know, or something to begin the meal with. I guess lettuce would actually come last now that I think about it.
Well, so, actually, in Spain, and I have had the privilege of having a lunch or two at Flores's house with you over the years, and I remember this being true of her house as well. Before the lunch even starts, which is going to be like a 3 or 4 hour affair, before it even starts, everyone has a beer and something sort of salty and crunchy and snacky before they even bring out, you know, the soup or whatever the first course
right.
is.
Right. That's right. 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 So, and then she would have the soup and it might have been like, you know, like a green bean puree with olive oil, something super mm-hmm. simple. And then she might have fried up a fish in a way that I've never had anybody fry up a fish in my life. And the fish would be the only thing on your plate at that moment. Mm-hmm. And then you might finish it with like some crispy butter lettuce or something mm-hmm. like that. And so each thing came separately and was allowed to shine and breathe. And between that was all the conversation and the wine. And so she just really impacted my aesthetic and my way of thinking about the simplicity of things and letting good food and good ingredients and good materials kind of just speak for themselves and shine.
Sort of beyond what you learned from her or, you know, skills or knowledge that you acquired from her, would you say that she changed you as a person?
It's an interesting question. I guess I'm having a hard time answering it because I can't even imagine my life without Flotus anymore. So I guess that would mean that she changed me. I mean, you know, she's fundamentally inside me. Mm-hmm. I mean, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't think of her several times a day. Mm. In my kitchen, I have a picture of her and I don't have a picture. I mean, there's a couple pictures of my kid on the fridge, but there's no pictures of anybody else in our kitchen except for the photo of her and I.
Mm, and so, I love that it's in your kitchen because that was really the heart of her home.
Well, and when I went to visit her last year, she took me into her storeroom, and which now that she lives in just a little studio, she's kind of added, you know, the storeroom has become another space. I mean, she doesn't hang out in there, but right. she's made it kind of more welcoming as just mm-hmm. another space, right? And she took me into the storeroom. She said, there's something I want to show you. And she took me into the storeroom, and there was a photo of me and her on one of her storeroom shelves in Aww. Her kitchen.
Oh my goodness.
I was so moved by that. Mm-hmm. There were no other photos of anybody else. It was just yeah. that photo of me and her.
Yeah, and also like, you're using the word storeroom. I've been in that little room. And I just want to say for our listeners that that little storeroom, I mean, it's a storeroom because it's like all the stuff that she needs, but it there's no real place for it in her studio apartment. So it's like the pantry, the closet, the, you know, the storage room. But since we're talking about Flores, it's like these lovely sort of orderly stacks of the best kind of, you know, the highest quality of tuna conserved in the highest quality of olive oil. And, you know, it's not just on the shelf, like there's sort of a linen cloth underneath it or, you know, some kind of lace and it's all been ironed. Like, I don't even want to think about how often she goes in there. And I mean, think of the maintenance just to keep that place.
I mean, listen,
that's
I can't
not even
her
house.
I can't even like clean the cobwebs in the corners of my bedroom.
Right.
You know, or right. the baseboards, which I walk by every day, let alone a pantry closet. The idea of laying down something I ironed. I don't even own an iron. I don't yeah. own an iron.
Well, you know,
so
Flotus,
yeah, this is otherworld-like, you know?
Yeah. And she's quite elderly now, as you said. What did you say, 86, 88?
88 in July. Yeah.
And she also is struggling. She's beginning to struggle with dementia a little bit. Mm. So, you know, you look at the facts and you look at the statistics and she won't be here forever, you know? We're talking about a changing of the guard. Can you talk a little bit about what that means to you, not only to, you know, a life after Flores, but also a life after Flores is kind, you know, people who are cut from that cloth. You know, I don't know if that means Basque citizens from her generation or if it's something else, but what does that changing of the guard mean to you?
You know, having grown up really without grandparents, so to speak, I had a grandfather in my life, but we weren't that close. He died when I was 20. Not having had grandparents in my life, I never really understood just the immense value of older people. I know it sounds terrible to say, but I just didn't understand. And I had never experienced an older person being exceptionally kind to me over days and weeks and months. And that's what Flores showed me. Side by side, the context of the world that she came out of and represented. And, you know, my real dream would be to create an exhibit about Flores's life and the things in her home. I haven't been able to figure out how to do that in Spain or in Cuenca, but that's a dream that I have because I do think that a lot will be lost. And I'm not even Spanish, right? So, like, you know, there's people that know women like Flores and have been moved and touched by, you know, these other women. And certainly also the role that women played in that group of painters. Mm. They, you know, I mean, to be able to do an exhibit around the wives of these painters, the wives and partners of these painters is something that I would love to see come full circle at some point. But,
well, and to bring the conversation full circle a bit, at the beginning of the interview, you were talking about when you had a manuscript and so did your husband and you decided to put your resources and your energy behind him. I mean, I think that's a story as old as time, isn't it?
Girl, seriously.
What do you think we can do to keep to maintain the legacy of these people who we will inevitably lose at some point? What actions can we take in our own lives to sort of keep their memory alive or their energy alive?
Well, I suppose that's the heartbreak of life, right? Is that, you know, people spend their lives becoming hopefully better humans and then they leave us. So just as, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's the weirdness of life, right? Is you just get this little bit of time. So anyway, I think that the opportunity with these folks is to get them to tell their stories. And they make us so much richer. It's not for them, you know? I mean, maybe it's for them, but it's for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's for us. Well, Devorah, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It has been such a pleasure to spend this time with you. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Kate. Appreciate this. I hope that this comes together in the way that you would like and that I was able to give you some good answers.
So. For sure. Thank you so much.
Next time on Listen, we'll be joined by writer Brooke Berman, who will be sharing her experiences as a playwright, screenwriter, and memoirist. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where the first stones of the original Muslim fortress were laid in the 8th century. Check out our archives at thelistenpodcast.com. There are 5 full seasons waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. Lauren Lovett is our producer. Caitlin Fisher handles our social media. And Lidia Munoz Solera writes our blog.
Editing, tech support, and original music are courtesy of Lucas Munoz Jetmore. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is Listen.